91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. In the past 15 years, have election lawyers become the dominant figures in deciding the course of American politics? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Since the landmark Bush versus Gore case in 2000, there have been legal battles to expand and contract the right to vote in many states. Does legal wrangling keep the average of 60% of non-voters at home? There are now many pre-election cases to be decided, as well as direct challenges. There's a long tradition of election court battles, but today's contests usually occur before elections. We'll speak with Hamline University political science professor David Schultz, as well as Florida ACLU executive director Howard Simon. That's next. First, the news. And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. It's Election Day. The U.S. has a tradition of legal battles concerning elections. The big one, of course, was in 2000, Gore versus Bush. And in the past, most legal issues were after elections. Today, there are more filed before them. Joining us now is political science professor David Schultz of Hamline University. That's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Professor Schultz has written the book Election Law and Democratic Theory, and he joins us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Welcome to you, Professor Schultz.
Thank you very much for having me today.
It's our pleasure.
Also with us this afternoon is the executive director of the Florida ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. He's Howard Simon. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask both of you this question. Are there currently voting rights laws in place in Florida that make our tight gubernatorial race closer than it might have been without them? And we'll start with you, Professor Schultz.
Well, clearly there are. And what we don't really think about in Florida 2000, you know, Bush v. Gore really got us to think about how does a whole framework of laws out there, including in Florida and across the country, that determine who gets to vote, how you get to vote, where you get to vote, even who appears on the ballot. And so in the state of Florida, we can just start with a whole bunch of issues determining questions regarding voter eligibility, for example. What kind of registration requirements are in place? We could talk about issues also in terms of who's ineligible to vote, in terms of individuals who have been convicted of felonies. And we could also talk about laws that also impact, for example, where you go to vote. And so there are a whole host of laws in Florida, as is as across the rest of the United States, that could have a huge impact in terms of who actually wins the election today, whether it's for the governorship or for any other of the races in the state of Florida.
And Howard, your feelings?
Well, I think the legislature took action to try to put up as many barriers as they can. They were embarrassed by what happened in the last presidential election and the long lines, and they had to give back a little bit of what they took away. But at the end of the day, to use that trite phrase, there are still cutbacks on early voting, cutbacks on the amount of number of early voting hours. There is still the case that there is not a right to change your address on election day at the polls and vote a regular ballot. And as the professor alluded to, we still have maybe 1.5 million people in the state of Florida who are citizens, taxpaying citizens, who are ineligible to vote. One of three states in the country that disfranchise people for the rest of their lives upon a felony conviction. All of those things, limits on opportunities to vote, limits on making sure that your vote is going to be able to count, and limits on who gets to vote, is certainly things that make the elections in Florida tighter and closer.
In the 2012 debacle, part of the problem was the ballot itself, and the amendments were so lengthy and wordy Is that something that's done intentionally to confuse voters sometimes? And also, Professor Schultz, is that a national trend to make constitutional amendments on state ballots difficult to decipher?
Well, I can answer sort of two questions here. You know, first is that when we look at the trends across the United States, you know, we can either accept sort of one framework of arguments that says that the concerns about voter qualifications, voter ID, all the different restrictions that we're seeing out there, one interpretation is to suggest that this is in order to be able to address questions such as voter fraud or improve security of ballots to prevent things from going wrong. A contrary interpretation says that this is clearly an effort to try to disenfranchise people. I subscribe to that view that says that a lot of these efforts clearly have an intention to impact the outcome of an election, that if you can sort of determine in advance who's going to get to vote or how, you can have a huge impact in terms of who's going to vote. So that's sort of one question. The second question is really about ballot design and questions. And there is both an intentionality and I think a haphazardness to this. And the intentionality is, again, some people will say that it's intentionally designed to be misleading ballot propositions or constitutional amendments to confuse people. But the other thing, and I think this is true, and I've done this with my students in class, is to say that there's a difference between testing a ballot in a, let's say, a classroom or in a non-pressure situation versus having a ballot actually be used in a pressure situation. And by that, imagine you're standing in line with a bunch of people behind you, and you got people kind of shuffling their feet, they're in a hurry, and you're trying to get through the ballot. You're under a different set of constraints in terms of how you're reading a ballot. You feel pressured, maybe a little bit nervous. And I want to argue that a lot of times when ballots are designed, we don't test them under real conditions to find out how real people would actually react to them. So I think it's a combination of both intentionality and just bad testing of ballots in terms of how we construct them that causes some of the problems.
Well, on the first part of the question, Professor Schultz, when you were talking about voter fraud, you said you don't think it's voter fraud. You think that it's intentionality in trying to disenfranchise people. What makes you say that? What do we know about voter fraud that makes you say that?
Okay, we can look at, I'll start with a simple number. From the National Weather Service, we know that the chances of being struck in any given year by lightning, you as an individual, is about 1 in 1,000,000, so not very likely. The best studies that we have ever seen, absolute best studies, and they've been replicated, studied in many different ways across the country, suggest that the chances of showing that in-person voter fraud at the polls is a factor significant enough to affect the outcome of an election. We're looking at numbers that are in like the 10 over the 150 million numbers. I mean, we're looking at, I call it the Powerball range, in terms of actually showing and proving documented instances of voter fraud. We really do not have any serious instances of in-person voter fraud in the United States. If there's any problems at all, it's by election officials manipulating, or it's by absentee ballots, but not in person. And we have several states that have really acknowledged that and proved that. And so we have to look at instead fact that we really don't have very significant voter fraud. Why are people pushing this? And I argue that what we're seeing right now is part of what I call the second great disenfranchisement battle in American history. If the first disenfranchisement battle came after the Civil War, after Reconstruction ended, and there was this effort through the Jim Crow era to prevent freed African-American males from voting, and it was very successful until the Voting Rights Act in the 60s, we're seeing that same battle here. And unfortunately, it has a partisan tint to it, that across the country we've seen this year, the vast majority of efforts to try to, in fact, maybe all the essence efforts to try to restrict voting through voter ID or curl to curtail early voting are occurring with Republicans or Republican governors pushing it. And it clearly has this look, and we know this from the evidence, of impacting who actually gets to turn out to vote. And it hugely impacts whom? Low-income people, students, people of color, people who are generally voting for Democrats.
Howard, you wanted to add something?
Well, I think this is the most interesting issue that I think we have. Polls indicate that somewhere around 75% of the American public believes that voter fraud is a serious problem. Yet there is no evidence of voter fraud. And But the fact that they have been encouraged to believe that that is a problem has an impact on what our public policies are and what the legislature is. Professor Schultz may not know this. He's a Minnesotan. But in fact, we live in an area right here in which there, frankly, is a considerable amount of voter fraud. There are cases now in federal court in which people are being charged with voter fraud. We live in a city here in Miami in which, if you can remember, I think it was the late 90s,
yes,
in which the mayoral election was overturned by the courts because of what the courts called rampant voter fraud in the absentee ballot. But all of the changes made by the legislature and approved by the current governor were changes that were to address in-person voter fraud, and they did nothing about the potential of where there really is fraud in the absentee ballot system. And if you think about it, how massively would you have to organize an in-person voter fraud campaign to try to affect an election? I mean, it's kind of absurd. I think what really is going on here is that, and this is what the professor's book, I think, is in part about, so I'd like to hear him comment on this. I think the dirty little secret of American politics is that not only is a politics about getting out your supporters, it's also the other half of it is about trying to depress the vote of your opponents. And a lot of what we have seen in Florida, all of these things, and the professor said this, I'm just echoing what he said, many of these changes are really designed to make it more difficult for certain disfavored groups. And look, I have to say it honestly, mainly we're talking about black people. We're talking about what can be done. I mean, I think our legislature looked at what happened in 2008, and they saw that there was a tremendous turnout of young people and a tremendous turnout of black people. And the changes that they made, for example, to ban Sunday voting, where there was an organized effort of Souls to the Polls, to make it to require that students who are attending college away from their home would have to vote by provisional ballot. The changes they made were really focused on certain disfavored groups. And the professor's right. It has a partisan ramification.
Yeah, I was going to follow up. I was going to say, just quick follow up here, is that I do know about your election down that was overturned a few years ago. You know, I teach that in my election law seminar in law school. But the point, I think we agree on this, is that where the fraud occurred was not with in-person voting,
right.
But either an absentee or with election official administration. And most of the reforms, I call it, put in quotation marks, the reforms that are being put in place are addressing in-person fraud, which, again, as I mentioned before, you have a better chance of being struck by lightning than you do in terms of actually showing in-person fraud. And I don't know what, actually, I have relatives, you know, in West Palm Beach in that area, so I know the area pretty well. And I was going to say that if your area of the country is like my area of the country, you know, when I go to vote, you know, I've got election official judges who have been there for like 25 and 30 years. If anybody tried to show up and impersonate me, they would know right off the bat. They would be able to recognize these kind of people. So again, it's an incredible myth in terms of that in-person fraud. I want to throw out one other thing.
But most people believe it. That's the
I know most people do believe it, and it's absolutely correct. And it becomes easy to sort of say that my side lost because of fraud. It was a bunch of dirty, rotten, fill in the blank, et cetera, you know, who weren't allowed to vote, who actually did vote. And it becomes kind of a scapegoat argument for explaining, you know, turnouts the way they are. And that's unfortunate because what we've really have done, I think, in the last generation is politicized voting rights. Because if we actually, it's always been the case. We've always politicized voting rights, but it's sort of been repoliticized again. You know, we want to think, and in my law school classes, I'll come in right on the chalkboard. I still use chalk, and I'll say to my students, we think voting is a fundamental right, that it's one of those things that's actually sacrosanct. But when we realize all the restrictions that are placed upon voting, all the conditions that are surrounding it, I really argue that effectively in this country, we have a highly conditioned privilege to vote that has been subject to so many regulations that it really does dissuade lots of people from voting in the United States, and including, of course, in Florida.
We're listening to Professor David Schultz of Hamline University, Department of Political Science. He also holds an appointment at the University of Minnesota Law School, and he's written Election Law and Democratic Theory. Also with us, Howard Simon, the Executive Director of the Florida ACLU. A short break. We'll come back and ask for your calls and emails.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with political science professor David Schultz, author of Election Day and Democratic Theory, and also with the executive director of the Florida ACLU, Howard Simon. Professor Schultz, there isn't any constitutional right to vote. What was the reasoning behind the proverbial founding fathers to leave so much to the states in that regard?
Well, if we look at the text of the Constitution, we see no explicit language that it grants a right to vote. And in 1787, the right to vote was basically delegated down to the states to determine eligibility. So, for example, eligibility to vote for your local state houses, you know, state legislatures, would also determine whatever eligibility there would be to vote for at the United States level. But let's think about who was actually eligible to vote in the United States under state law in 1787, the year of the writing of the Constitution. And it was our proverbial, white Anglo-Saxon older Protestant property owner. And if we look at the history of the United States over a 230-year period, that many of the restrictions that were in place at the state level have been overturned. We've got several constitutional amendments, that have granted women the right to vote. 15th Amendment, freed African American slaves, younger people. But look at all the amendments. They don't actually affirmatively say the right to vote. They say the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the account of gender or on age or on race. It's all phrased in the negative. Where our right to vote is found is actually the Supreme Court has said that there are several clauses in the Constitution that sort of implicitly grant a right to vote. But we really don't have that affirmative language in the same way that other countries have in terms of a federal right to vote. And for the large extent, states are given the authority to be able to determine eligibility. And so for both the state elections and the federal elections that are occurring in Florida, it is going to be primarily the state laws that are in place that are going to decide who is eligible to be able to vote in the state of Florida for whether it be governor or, I'm not sure. I think you have a U.S. senator on the ballot this year, too, a Senate race on the ballot for Senate.
No,
you don't? Okay, you don't. Okay, so it'll be for any congressional races and then for, again, any state races that are there. But again, what's really odd is the fact that we are one of the few countries in the world that doesn't really have an affirmative, clear language in our national constitution that grants the right to vote.
We want to get our listeners involved. Have you experienced difficulty voting on account of changes in voting laws? Or do you feel disenfranchised? Have you decided not to vote because of that? Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org.
Gentlemen, sometimes a high turnout can favor, at least historically, can favor one party, sometimes another. We've been talking pretty much that today's Republicans are against more restrictive voting rules and regulations. But historically, haven't both parties been involved in this kind of shenanigans?
Well there's no question. Howard, you go first.
It certainly is the case, especially when you look at redistricting, for example, that whoever is
in power. Joe Kennedy in Chicago.
Right, and whoever's in power has tried to manipulate the rules. In fact, I think that that's what should most upset your listeners and what should most upset the general public, because I think what's going on is that the politicians are manipulating the voting system so that they benefit in many, many different ways, limiting who can vote, redistricting so that the people in power, they design their own districts to help, essentially give them job protection. The fact that they are resistant to changes that would dramatically increase the number of people to vote, young people. We have, for example, we have a law in Florida, I bet it's more honored in the breach than in honoring it, to pre-register young people. Young people can be, why don't we have a system that we kind of train and get more young people ready to vote? So I think what's going on is a general manipulation of all of the rules of voting in every way by the politicians. And I think that should make the people angry. We're a voting rights organization. I'm not interested in whether or not any of the changes benefit one party or the other. What I do see is that both parties conspire to keep in place rules that really reduce voting. And I have to say, please, and let's focus on this, there is no state in the country that takes the right to vote away from more people than the state of Florida with regard to its policy of lifetime disfranchisement. At least 1.5 million people in Florida are disfranchised from voting.
Professor?
Yeah, one quick story, and then I want to give some statistics here. One of my favorite stories, it's about election official manipulation. I think it was one of Robert Carroll's biographies of Lyndon Johnson, points out when he first ran for the state Senate in Texas, that he was behind, and at the last minute, they found some missing ballots from Corpus Christi, where I think it was like 100 people, dead people, voted. And not only did they vote, but they voted in alphabetical order, which was really, really nice of them to be able to do that, to make it easier to sort of tabulate, So those are the stories that we hear. It's about that kind of manipulation. But a couple statistics here that I can make a very good bet that by the end of the day, when we look at all the numbers for the midterm elections this year, that about 60% of the American public will not vote today or at early voting. That even in our best, go back 2 years ago during the presidential election, about 45% of Americans don't vote. We have an enormous percentage of our population that doesn't vote. And again, it's that. And I always pose to my students and say, the same people who voted, legally could vote in 1787, generally are the same people who actually do vote to this day. And on election day, we're going to see the poor, the young, people of color, people with past criminal records. They're going to be the ones who don't vote. And part of it's legal changes. Part of it's that if we tampered with things in terms of making it easier to register to vote, or election day registration, mm-hmm. or more frequent places, or easier places to get to vote, we could increase some of the percentages. But there still is this residual. And I was talking about this in class this morning. We've got a lot of people in this country who just don't show up to vote because in many cases, they don't feel like perhaps there's a reason to vote. And so we've got a series of complex problems here. One is about the legal restrictions on the ability to vote, and two, what may be the deeper motivational reasons why people don't want to vote, because they may not feel like their vote matters, or they may not just sort of feel like that the choices that they have before them are ones that they want. And in many situations, because all the states in the country have their election systems controlled by the two major parties, they conspired together to make it difficult for third-party candidates to run, for people to be able to do write-in votes, to maybe excise a whole range of options that might encourage more people to participate.
We have an emailer, Denise. My mother's a non-driver who moved to Florida. She registered to vote last year. When we went to vote in the August 2014 election, they refused to let her vote because her ID was a New York State photo ID, even though she had her Florida's voter's registration card. I was under the impression that the photo ID was merely to identify yourself and your signature against the voter rolls, not to verify eligibility. In fact, they were willing to take a bank card with photo, but not an out-of-state ID. Howard?
I'd like to talk with her. That may be a good case for the ACLU. I think that's absurd. I mean, the point of ID is to make sure that you are who you say you are.
She's asking that you clarify the law for what ID is required.
If you give me a minute, I have a that's another thing that the legislature did recently. They reduced the number of pieces of valid ID that would serve as ID, and I think I have that list with me. So,
Howard's looking for a second here, I could say that across the country, with I think it's about 34 states with some kind of photo ID, it's a mess in terms of what's required. In some states, it's only a driver's license they'll accept. In some states, it'll be driver's license, student ID. It'll be any other kind of form of picture ID. In some situations, it has to be a driver's license with a current correct address, current correct name. And this impacts lots of different people. We know that, for example, a lot of elderly people don't have driver's license. Or I could do another situation here where a lot of students who are moving to go to school don't have them. Or a lot of women still change their names when they get married, and they may not have their married name listed on that driver's license or that government ID, and they face problems also. So it really is kind of a mishmash across the country in terms of where they do have photo ID, what it's being used. And of course, that also creates confusion for election judges, because election judges may just not even know or may be confused themselves regarding what is actually required to be able to show proof to be able to vote.
So let me say, for people who are your listeners who haven't yet voted, there are 9 forms of legal voter ID that are acceptable by state law in the state of Florida. A Florida driver's license, a Florida ID card issued by the Department of Highway and Safety Motor Vehicles, a passport, a debit or a credit card should be acceptable, military ID, a student ID, retirement center ID, neighborhood association ID, or a public assistance ID. 9 different forms of ID. It was a longer list. The legislature cut that back as well.
Well, we're going to take a break on our program. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It's the election day. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with David Schultz. He's the author of Election Law and Democratic Theory, and also the executive director of Florida ACLU. He's Howard Simon. If you'd like to join in, our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, also emails, that's radio at WLRN.org. Let's take a first caller. In fact, his call relates to what we were discussing before about picture IDs. Guy in Hollywood, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Good show. Thanks, very informative. Just a quick question regarding another level of required ID. I went and voted this morning like a good citizen, and just to be a rabble-rouser, I asked the ladies there what would happen if I didn't have a photo ID, and they said I couldn't vote. So I went and researched online, and it said they could have given me a different type of ballot, a provisionary ballot that would have been counted, and I'm just wondering if that is the law or not. Should I, if you don't have a photo ID or any kind of ID, can you still vote if you have a voter's ID card?
Absolutely. This is one of the changes that occurred after the disaster of the 2000 election in here in Florida. Nobody should be turned away. If you don't have the proper ID, if your signature doesn't match, if the people at the desk don't think you are, everybody should be entitled to vote. If you don't have the proper ID or there's a problem with the signature, you vote a provisional ballot. But nobody should be turned away without being allowed to vote.
Would you like
either
to bring
a regular
in,
ballot or a provisional ballot?
Would you like to bring in Nancy Abudu?
Yeah, our legal director.
She's on the line with us.
Is right now is at a. She's at a. Actually, she's staffing a hotline for people who are having problems with the election on voting day.
She heard the question. Perhaps she
and so anyway, Nancy Abudu, she is the legal director of the ACLU Florida and formerly senior staff lawyer with the National ACLU Voting Rights Project.
So, Nancy, welcome to Topical Currents.
Thank you.
So did you hear Guy's question?
Yes, I did. And as Howard said, that's right. There should never be an instance where you believe you have the right to vote, you are at the right polling place, or believe you are, and you're not allowed to cast even a provisional ballot. When it comes to having to cast a provisional ballot because your ID is considered insufficient, it is true that in Florida you do have to show a photo ID, but that can include a passport, a debit card, a credit card. So if you don't have any kind of ID with your picture on it, then yes, you are allowed to cast a provisional ballot. In most instances, you are going to have to come back to the election office and show your proper ID in order for your ballot to count. So you'll want to make sure if you're casting a provisional ballot that you get all of the directions necessary related to you making sure that ballot indeed counts.
Denise writes, go ahead, Professor Schultz.
I was going to say also with the provisional ballots, you also have a certain number of days, I think. Is it like 10 days? I'm not sure what it's in Florida, but it's like 10 days or something from the time you cast a provisional ballot to when you actually have to show up with the proper ID?
That is correct. I would want to double check, but I think it's a lot shorter in Florida. I'm almost inclined to say, yeah, but I believe that it's much shorter.
Right. That's an important thing to point out here is that if you do get those provisional ballots, ask among the questions you pointed here, how many days do I have to actually be able to show up with the proper documentation? Because otherwise, then they're not going to count your ballot.
Nancy, what's the most common complaint that you receive from voters denying them access to the polls?
Well, today, and I think supported in a lot of the media reports, have been the calls about people not knowing where their proper precinct is. That's related, of course, to the reprecincting that Miami-Dade went through. There were about 6% of voters who were impacted, but that's still a significant number. And so I think the frustration you're hearing from voters today has to do with the fact that they're going to places where they traditionally have voted, and many times they're actually standing in line waiting for them to be processed, only to get to an election worker and be told they're in the wrong place. And if indeed they're at the wrong precinct, they should, you know, they really do have to go to their right polling place, or they run the risk of their ballot not even being counted.
If someone has stood in line and they've just been rejected, since it is election day, is there a number that they can call to get advice?
Yes. 866-OUR-VOTE is the election protection hotline that we're encouraging people to
use. Could you say that again? We had a little glitch.
866-OUR-VOTE. 866-OUR-VOTE.org. I'm sorry, 866-OUR-VOTE is the number to call.
Denise writes here, I don't know, maybe you know the answer to this, Nancy. Her question remains, is an out-of-state photo ID a legitimate form of photo ID to vote in Florida if you have a voter's registration card?
So if you are registered in Florida properly, you can use of any acceptable form of photo identification. The poll workers should not be checking the address on your ID to make sure that it matches in their database. The purpose of showing the ID is not address.
We have a caller on the line who has a voter ID issue I guess experienced today. Richard in Hallandale, you're on with us. Hi.
Hello, Richard. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I went in earlier this morning to vote. And I had my voter registration card actually tells me to go to that particular district. My license matches the information, I guess, on the voter ID card. But when I went up to register, it brings up an address of a place I've never lived, and they told me that's where I have to go vote. The clerk actually tried to process it for me, and she told me to go to another polling station. I went to that polling station because she said she corrected the address, and still they were telling me that I have no choice. I have to go to this other polling station. This district I've never voted in at all. So I was wondering, what are the rules behind, if your voter registration card matches your license, why is it showing a different address to a different location?
See, we've lost Nancy. Can you...
That's got to be sorted out.
That just sounds
out.
Some sort of computer glitch.
Yeah, I have no idea. Unfortunately, that's going to have to be sorted out after the election. But I would, I would vote a provisional ballot. And then
I heard about that, but they didn't offer me any other options. I spent 3 hours at the first polling station to be sent another one saying that they could, and then they sent me away again.
Well, I always advise people not to vote a provisional ballot because there's always an issue about it, whether it's going to be counted. But in your case, you have no choice. I think you should vote a provisional ballot, and then you got a few days to go down to Brenda Snipes' office in Fort Lauderdale, the supervisors of elections office, and straighten out what is clearly a computer problem with your correct address.
But Howard, Richard was at the poll for three,
he probably doesn't want to go out.
Three hours to go at out. One poll, then another place, and now he has to go back again.
He's going to have to get this thing fixed after the election, probably.
Right, or go down to the supervisors now and see if you can get a provisional ballot right there at the desk at the supervisors' headquarters.
Right, but the story here speaks. Your story here speaks to sort of, you know, one of the problems oftentimes with some of the voter ID requirements is that a lot of times they're supposed to be computer matches to maybe some state central data bank or something. And as we know, a lot of these are oftentimes keyed into things such as our driver's license number. All kinds of things can happen. There's all kinds of typo errors. People can transpose numbers. You know, who knows? I mean, this situation here, somebody might have you confused with somebody else by that exact same name. I was going to say that in the state of Minnesota, you know, we had allegations of voter fraud a few years ago where people claimed and said, well, there was a person, I'm just going to make up a name, John Smith voted twice from the same address. Well, it was John Smith Sr., John Smith Jr., who were actually voting. And so, of course, two John Smiths, you know, voted. And so the point is that your situation points to exactly some of the problems that we also have beyond any kind of intentionality. Just human error causes sometimes these mistakes where people are disenfranchised, not because they're trying to because they're trying to fraud anybody, but mistakes are happening also.
Let me give out the number that was mentioned for inquiries about voting, and I'm sure that's good in all the counties in our listening area. 866 Our Vote. That's 866-O-U-R-V-O-T-E. 866-O-U-R-V-O-T-E. Tell me, Professor Schultz, what national 2014 races most interest the scholars and concerning voting rights?
Well, I think a couple of them. One of them is going to be North Carolina, which is a very close Senate race up there. And there's been lots of litigation in North Carolina regarding both the counting of provisional ballots, especially if a person shows up the wrong precinct and votes, whether or not those provisional ballots are going to be counted. And at the same time, we've also had some restrictions there in terms of early voting. Same thing in Ohio, which has always been a perennially important swing state, much like Florida is, that some of the rules regarding early voting were prevented from going to effect. And then the state of Wisconsin, right next to me, you know, very, very close race between Scott Walker and Mary Burke. The Supreme Court is basically enjoining, preventing the voter ID from going into effect until after the election, if at all, at that point. And so just pick those three states alone, you know, and we've got, you know, significant, you know, pre-election litigation about voting rights. And depending on how close the elections are, clearly, you know, if they're very close, you're going to see one side or the other, you know, going to court claiming that there was fraud, there was miscounting. And it's all going to be surrounding, connecting to some of these pre-election laws that were either allowed to go into place or were enjoined from going into place. So those are just some examples that I've looked at here. But I want to tell one other story, that a district judge in mid-October struck down the voter ID law in Texas that a Supreme Court eventually is going to allow to be put into place. What's fascinating about that law is that the district court judge in about a 150-page opinion found that the new photo ID law in the state of Texas would disenfranchise up to 600,000 people who are currently registered to vote in the state of Texas. And that's important because 600,000 votes, think about that, that is easily enough to sway the outcome of any election, even in the state of Texas. And so across the country, we're seeing that this election, either the appearance of some laws or the court decisions may very well not only affect who actually does vote, but afterwards we might see, if in close races, a continuation of this litigation going on way beyond. And so I would say at this point, North Carolina, I would say, you know, maybe Ohio, Wisconsin, and I'd also say Louisiana, because Louisiana may be an election that we don't get the results on for a long time, and they may have to go to a runoff. I would think the laws down there will be a big impact too.
I just want to add that judge in Texas who struck down the voter ID law, she called it, I believe it was a she, racially motivated, and she said it amounted to a poll tax.
Yes, she did. In fact, she had some incredible statistics that said that people of color, blacks and Hispanics, if I remember correctly, were between something like 200% and 300% more likely to be disenfranchised by the law than were white Caucasians. And she said that not only was this a law having a disparate impact upon people of color, but she said there was clear intentionality, clear racial animus in terms of trying to discriminate against people of color there. And so that's rare for a judge to come out with that kind of language. But then again, the surprise was that the Supreme Court, you know, basically, you know, stays that decision and says, we're going to let the voter ID law go into effect. And again, with there potentially being, you know, a very hotly contested race down there for the governor, that law could have a huge impact on the outcome of that race.
We're speaking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University and University of Minnesota Law School, who's written election law and democratic theory. Also with us, Howard Simon, the executive director of the Florida ACLU. A break, and we'll take more of your calls.
Forty-nine minutes past 1 o'clock. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, along with Professor David Schultz and Howard Simon, the executive director of the Florida ACLU. We're getting short on time. Let's take calls. Mark in Miami Beach. Hi. Mark, you're
Hello?
Up. Go ahead.
Hi. I haven't voted yet today, but the last time I did vote, I noticed something peculiar about the ballot itself.
Well, we needed to concentrate on today's ballot.
No, I think it's endemic.
Was there a trend? Okay, go ahead.
So when I looked at the ballot itself, like half the actual physical page of the ballot was taken up by Republican, Democrat, and then all the independent candidates got these small little physical spaces to represent their names on it. So when you pay for an ad, say in an advertisement for a newspaper, you pay more for space on that ad. I'm wondering why those two parties are given preferential.
Well, this time I didn't see that on this ballot that we're dealing with now.
Well, so you didn't notice that.
Well, not this time.
Every single candidate had the exact amount of space, and the same. It wasn't like Republican, Democrat in first position, and the others in a secondary or third position.
No, they were right below.
They were right below. So why not above?
Oh
no, actually the placement is a random selection. That they have to change that. Not every ballot is Democrat, Republican, minor. That they are randomly ordered.
Assigned there, yeah.
I want to ask you, Professor Schultz, we have an emailer who said she was turned off by the choices and everybody was making personal attacks, and it's always picking the lesser of two evils. You mentioned that in the literature. So what do you say to those who have decided not to vote because they feel that their choices really aren't choices, which so many people do feel?
Well, it's a tough dilemma because there are lots of people who don't feel like they really have a choice when they show up. And what I oftentimes tell people is, at the very least, show up, and if nothing else, at least write somebody in. You know, I don't care whether you write in M. Mouse or D. Duck or something like that. You know, write somebody in at this point, because even if you know, for two reasons. First is that a lot of people, you know, gave a lot of blood and fought very hard to get the right to vote. And in some sense, we don't want to squander that. Second is that I think we can still send a message by showing up to vote, even if we don't cast the vote for you know, one of the two major parties. And then I think the sort of the third answer I give to them is that even if you don't like the choices there, you know, I mean, showing up to vote, but it's also participation is not just voting. You know, we think everything comes down to just simply who do we get to vote for on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. There's also all the other stuff in terms of showing up to primaries. There's showing up in terms of volunteering for candidates. There's a whole bunch of other things. And I think we need to expand it and say that if you really want to have a chance to be able to make a decision up, there's a lot of things that occur before we actually get to the ballot on election day. That's only one piece of the puzzle. And so I still say show up to vote, but even before voting, there's a whole bunch of other political activities that we ought to engage in to be able to influence the political process.
We hear so much about vote, 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 vote. Is it really, though, correct to almost chastise people to vote, especially if they know nothing about what they're voting for? just to go to the polls because they've heard that they're supposed to, but they know nothing. They're not informed at all whatsoever.
Well, clearly the chastisement is to try to get people to take more seriously the right to vote. But again, I mean, the story that I will tell is that there are a lot of people who can't get off on election day because they're working or they're more worried about putting food on the table. I mean, there are a lot of other things that are going on in people's lives that may make voting seem, you know, relatively unimportant. And so, yes, I do think we want to encourage people to try to vote as much as possible, but we also ought to be doing a much better job in our society of figuring out why, again, if I'm going to be correct here, why 60% of the American public isn't going to vote by the time this election
There's some obligation to being a citizen, and it's not just it's just the obligation on the part of election officials. The citizen has an obligation to get themselves informed, and I must say, I have little patience with people who say, oh, I don't like the choices, so I'm not going to vote. You know, first of all, politics is very frequently the lesser of two evils, but also there's a big ballot. There are all sorts of other things. There's congressional. Right. We have three important constitutional amendments on the ballot. There's a big, long ballot of other things that you're voting for, judges, members of the city council, mayor, so on and so on. Just because you don't like the top of the ticket is not a reason not to vote.
Should we have about 3 minutes left. Can we talk about some reforms
that each of you would like to see?
Yes.
Starting with you, Howard.
Well, I think there are three major reforms. I think number one, I'll be as quickly as we got to do something about money in politics. Look, I think our political system has been hijacked by rich people and rich anonymous people to make things even worse. This is a different political system than we had a couple of decades ago. I think it's we have lost our democracy by that. Look, the major restriction on voting is to be registered. We have to do something to first register more people. We can do that online. We can get ourselves into the electronic era. We can use the public schools to do that. And there's only partisan reasons why we don't have same-day registration. And the third and final reform that I think is the most important in Florida and is distinctly Florida, we've got to do something about the system of lifetime felon disfranchisement that makes a million and a half people ineligible to vote. It's a remnant of the racist Civil War policies that we had that were designed to reduce the number of black people to vote.
Professor, let's hear from you, and we're very short on time.
Sure. Okay. I agree with the sort of getting the money out of politics, or at least rethinking how we finance campaigns. Second, I would move towards nonpartisan redistricting commissions and take that power out of the legislature because it's a conflict of interest. Right. And then third, it would be some kind of day of election registration. And if I could throw in a fourth here for voting, is that I would do a much better job with old-fashioned civics education, especially with high school seniors.
Do you have more? You have a little. we're not limiting you.
We rush you a little too much.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. 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 If I were going to throw a couple others out there, again, I think Howard hit at some of them. I would do a much better job in terms of having disclosure laws in place. But I would also say there is a constitutional aspect here in that I actually do think we need a constitutional amendment that affirmatively grants a right to vote in what it's supposed to mean, because we don't have that right now, and we clearly need to have that.
Well, we want to encourage all of you to vote today. Mm-hmm. And again, if you do have questions or issues with voting, that number that we got from Nancy Abudu is 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 1-866-OURVOTE. We've been speaking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University and of the University of Minnesota Law School. And he's written Election Law and Democratic Theory. And also with us today was Howard Simon, the executive director of the Florida ACLU, and also Nancy Abudu, who's the legal director of the Florida ACLU. We want to thank all of you for joining us.
Indeed. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And that wraps up today's program. It was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. He's responsible for our Facebook and WLRN Topical Currents website. Also, for more information, related links, discussion, and photos, you can see Bonnie We have audio downloads at our website, WLRN.org. See our photos at Topical Currents Facebook.
And you can see Joe 40 years ago.
Much better than now. Tomorrow's program examines 2 centuries of actions by the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, with constitutional expert Erwin Chemerinsky. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned. Here and Now is next from NPR News.